Sebastian Younger's new book is about a long walk he took with veterans he met covering the war in Iraq along active train lines, which is illegal. Do not try it. Actually, Sebastian Younger's new book is about Genghis Khan, Daniel Boone, runaway slaves, boxing, and the 17th century Dutch scholar Hugo Grotius, to name just a few things. And it's such a slim little book with such a simple title, Freedom. But there's nothing simple about the questions that word evokes. Sebastian also wrote The Perfect Storm, made the Oscar-nominated film Restrepo about an army platoon in Afghanistan with photographer Tim Hetherington, who was killed in Libya before they could take that walk on the railroad lines together. Instead, Sebastian took it with those veterans, and it became the basis of the HBO documentary The Last Patrol. In the new book Freedom, we have glimpses again of that last patrol, but mostly we're in Sebastian's head as he ponders that word, freedom. And Sebastian Younger joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
To remind people, we spoke with you and the lovely soldier, Brendan O'Byrne, back in 2014 about that walk you guys took. We'll have that story at herenow.org. It seemed an attempt to try to re-enter the country after combat. I mean, Brendan didn't think he fit in. When did it become about the meaning of freedom?
The walk that we took, I mean, we went 400 miles along active railroad lines from D.C. to Philly to Pittsburgh. We thought of ourselves as high-speed vagrants. And the whole time, I realized, like, every night, we were the only people in the world who knew where we were. And as I say in the book, there's a lot of definitions of freedom, but surely that's one of them. So when I set out to write a book about freedom and how humans come by it, how we are able to maintain our autonomy in the face of greater powers, more powerful societies or people, I sort of cast my mind back on this weird trip that we had done. And I thought, that's an example of freedom, among other things. And so I thought I would weave the account of our high-speed vagrancy into a more researched look at how humans have maintained their freedom throughout the ages.
Well, also because you can hold something up to the light and it can look like freedom, but maybe it's not. So you were free as birds, as you say. You were, what was it? You would eat, walk, hide, sleep every day like scripture, true and honest. But you're also skirting these rail officials who would love to arrest you, weather that would love to kill you, suspicious diner owners, and in all of your cases, some demons, you know, dads who might have oppressed. So were you free?
It was a form of freedom. There isn't one kind of freedom. You know, what I would say is that the further out you go, the freer you are in one sense, but you're subject to great hardship and danger. We walked the length of Pennsylvania, mostly along the Juniata River, which was sort of the gateway to the unclaimed, what was called Indian lands of the 1700s. And settlers that went in there, they were subject to brutal attacks from the natives and vice versa. I mean, it was a very bloody time. They were enormously free from the government and from the church, but they were not free of danger. And as a result, they had to band together for a kind of mutual defense. And the agreement to defend each other against Indian attacks became itself a kind of social control. And if you were not willing, if you did not carry, as an adult man, if you did not carry a weapon at all times, you were derided, you were mocked, and ultimately banished from the community. So at the end of the day, you know, as freedom goes up, safety goes down, and you have to sort of pick your poison.
Right, right. You write, freedom also is, simply put, the absence of a threat. But that meant that freedom became something to die for. As you say, you have to band together. It was sacred, in which case you're not entirely free anymore. You're committed to that community that is helping you. And so we also see that, you know, people might envy each other's freedom. For instance, you talk about early nomads. This is thousands of years ago. And the farmers might have looked at the hunters in the mountains and said, wow, they're really free. I'm tied to the land. The hunter in the mountain look at the farmer and say, wow, you're so lucky you have a collective. You make food.
Yeah, I mean, it's just different ways of solving the human problem of survival. So the nomads were materially poor, but really were their own authority. There was no way for a king or a monarch, a tyrant, he had no dominion over the nomads. The farmers, of course, could stockpile food. They could accumulate a significant wealth, but they were bound to the land and bound to the social system that they were part of. What I figured out, the book is divided into three sections: run, fight, and think. I tried to figure out, how do humans maintain their autonomy in the face of a more powerful oppressor? first of all, you run away, right? Like the Apache in the American Southwest were very materially poor, but they maintained their autonomy for 300 years. The Pueblo societies in the same area, which were very wealthy, they got rolled up by the Spanish almost immediately. So mobility plays a huge role in freedom. And the, what you sacrifice for mobility is material wealth. You just cannot carry all your stuff around. But if you can't outrun your oppressor, you have to outfight them. Humans are virtually the only mammal where the smaller individual or the smaller group can defeat a larger one. The Taliban are a pretty good example, modern day example of this. I abhor them as a regime. They're horrible. But they had no tanks, no artillery, sometimes they, no air force, no boots. They defeated the most powerful military ever in history. They fought us to a standstill, and now we're leaving. And they will probably control Afghanistan. If the smaller group could not do that, really freedom would not be possible. We would have been defeated by the British, for example, in 1776.
We just got a sense of the span of this elegant little book. And I'm looking at page 77, 78. You go from a 1996 terrible, terrible commuter train accident in which an engineer jumps up to throw a brake. He's got 15 seconds to do it to save other people. An example of something that only started to happen in the 20th century, people, you know, saving others as opposed to saving their beloved, the people within their community. And then from there, we go to the derivation of the word freedom, which comes from the medieval German. And then we turn the page and we are there in Rome in 73 BCE. And then we're with Grotius, the Dutch scholar, who was the first who tried to extend this love of your own community and damn the enemy to the idea of human rights for all, even those conquered. What did you do here in the acknowledgments? You list about 30 huge tomes that you've read. What did you do here?
Well, I did a huge amount of research. So it's important to understand that for much of human history before international law and human rights law, your immediate freedom came from your ability to defend yourselves against an enemy. And eventually what we decided as a world is that there's international law that all nations must collaborate on, where human rights and human life must be collectively defended. And so you can be a tiny, tiny country, and hopefully, obviously this wasn't true in the run-up to World War II, but hopefully the big bully next door tries to invade you, the world will come to your aid, that your freedom doesn't just depend on being able to defend yourself yourself. But finally, as I say in the book, if a society that's well-organized enough to defend itself against an enemy is well-organized enough to oppress its own members, that brings us to the final chapter of my book, Think. So we have run, fight, and think. If you can't outrun your enemies or outfight them, you're going to have to outthink them. And I talk about the labor movement, you know, around 100 years ago. And, you know, they were completely outgunned, overpowered by the government, by the National Guard. They were fighting for fairness. I mean, the conditions were horrendous. One in five infants died in the immigrant communities. And they eventually won, but they won by basically outthinking the opponent. And, you know, one very important thing to point out is the role of women in those kinds of fights. The labor movement was losing, and then they put women on the front line. And the National Guard soldiers with fixed bayonets didn't know what to do. They were not willing to attack women. And as one frustrated police captain said in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912, one cop can handle 10 men. But it takes 10 cops to handle one woman. That was the beginning of the end of the government's ability to basically oppress workers in Massachusetts.
Yeah. Well, as we said, the freedom they were seeking was something that was sacred to them. They were willing to sacrifice for it. Now, you're right, it's taken for granted, which is why, you write, people can look at other requests for sacrifice. You cite rationing water during a drought. And, you know, kind of look at that as government tyranny. I'd say, you know, wearing a mask. Someone can say that is government tyranny.
Well, the word freedom is horribly misused. It's often misused by people who would like to carve out extra rights for themselves or want to create a rationale, a justification for oppressing someone else. What people have to understand is that freedom means freedom from oppression, not freedom from obligation.
That's Sebastian Younger. His new book is Freedom. It's about a walk and so much more. Sebastian, thank you.
Thank you.